Where do you live? In a big city or a small town? In a downtown or in the suburbs? No matter where you live, chances are you've got neighbors. They may reside in the apartment down the hall, in the house next door, or on a farm a few miles down the road. On the next Mind's Eye Radio, it's In the Neighborhood. We'll take a look at what it means to be a neighbor and what we do to build and preserve the neighborhoods we live in. It's In the Neighborhood from Mind's Eye Radio. It's radio within reach. Where do you live? In a big city or a small town? In a downtown or in the suburbs? No matter where you live, chances are you've got neighbors. They may reside in the apartment down the hall, in the house next door, or on a farm a few miles down the road. But human beings are social animals, and with few exceptions, our lives are intertwined with those of our neighbors. And the neighborhoods are like ships. Everyone on board must do his or her part to keep the vessel afloat. We accomplish that goal not so much by law and regulation as by living by a code of conduct that each of the neighbors implicitly agrees to follow. It's a remarkable system because it recognizes that we're in this world together, and to prevail, we need to stick together. I'm Greg Willard, and you've tuned into In the Neighborhood on Mind's Eye Radio. During the next hour, the Mind's Eye writers will take a look at what it means to be a neighbor and what we do to build and preserve the neighborhoods we live in. Stay tuned. In Norma Gay Pruitt's neighborhood, there's plenty of diversity to go around. Sometimes that variety may test her mettle, but it never fails to give her a deep sense of belonging.
It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood, a wonderful day for a neighbor. Won't you be mine? Won't you be mine? Neighboring by default. What can we expect of a random collection of people who, for financial or social or racial reasons, find themselves sharing the same geographical space? In other words, what are my responsibilities to my neighbor? The Bible says, love thy neighbor, but that doesn't work out very well if I take it literally. And the Bible says a lot of other mysterious things, like, if thine eye offend thee, pluck it out. But what if thy neighbor's eye offend thee? Well, I wouldn't recommend following that particular injunction. Neighborhoods are not tribes either, which are connected by blood and custom and belief and mores, and at campouts, some mores. Neighborhoods are not family most of the time, but rather odd people whose music you are bound to hate. I live on a tiny spit of land between two lakes, an isthmus, about maybe 8 to 12 blocks wide, depending on where you slice it. My house backs up to a sort of quadrant of houses with long and short backyards, so that when neighbors on one side smoke a cigarette and I'm sitting on my deck, I smoke too. Or when people waiting at the bus stop across the street are laughing loudly, I unwillingly share the joke in the summer when my windows are open. I hear their most personal insults when husbands and wives do yard work together, and they can't help but hear mine when my husband and I do the same. Animals are another problem. One neighbor feeds squirrels, which, feeling welcome, nest in our attic whenever they get a chance, chew our Christmas lights to bits, and hog the birdseed. Many people feel free to let their cats roam. It's natural, one told me. Yeah, when they lived on the savannah, but I've seen at least 6 cats and a couple of dogs squished on our crazy busy street. And of course, cats eat birds, which I feed. On the other hand, one person, high up in an apartment which abuts my backyard, plays the most beautiful, mournful sax near sundown. Another used to practice bagpipes in the church lot catty-corner from us, again as the sun set over the distant lake. It was haunting and beautiful, maybe a secret tribute to a lost friend. But most play boomboxes the size of refrigerators and the kind of music that takes 6 seconds to make me want to strangle a stranger. And I'm very sound sensitive. I can't stand the jerks who drive what we call boom cars, the kind that shake with the vibrations of the deafening music inside. But do they have the right? I don't know where the line is. In some suburbs and many condos, though not any I would care to live in, the neighborhood association or the developers or somebody has the power to restrict whatever they agree upon. For example, they can forbid you to string a clothesline and tell you what colors to paint your house. Here, I might be in trouble. As one who lives in a house that is painted in a color advertised as mauve, which is cool, but which turned out to be Pepto-Bismol pink, which is not cool, I feel sensitive about such stuff. And yet, occasionally, I sight a house that must have been painted for spite, lime green or cerulean blue, or, I have heard, painted like a big flag. Then I feel sorry for the neighbors, for verily I say unto you, I began to feel like plucking out my own eye. On the other hand, there are wonderful things about randomness in neighbors. Ours is a mixed neighborhood with a lot of absentee landowners renting mainly to students and a few on-location landowners, like me, trying to rent to older students or young working people, a sadly decreasing number of lifetime residents, and a few young families. Two blocks away is a tiny business district which, when I moved here, had a Whole Foods co-op, a butcher shop, a liquor store, a plumbing business, a rock shop, a knitting shop, a great regular grocery, a kids' clothing shop, a hair salon, and three little restaurants. Now we only have four of the above. You have to be an idiot not to be able to keep a liquor store viable, and we are the poorer for it. Lots of cute shops have come and gone, somebody's dreams down the spout. The storefronts sit lonely and dusty until another person has a great idea. Being neighbors means to me looking out for each other, as my older neighbors across the street and I do. If their lights are not on for a couple of days, I call or go over. If they see strange people lurking here, they call. I have watched their grandchildren, who were babies when my son was, but who now live most of the time in a fancier part of town, grow up and become real people. They have gone to school functions with my son and fuss endlessly over him. That's the kind of neighborhood I have in mind. Lots of our tenants have grown up, finished school, gotten married, sometimes to each other, and now the first has had a baby. People occasionally walk by the 100-year-old house we live in and pause. Sometimes, if I see them, I inquire if I can help. Sometimes they have lived next door to our house as children. One older man told me about watching the single lady, Helen Olson, who lived in our house her entire life, drying her hair by tossing it over her head in the sun amid the lilies in the backyard. I love that story. Sometimes I feel Helen is in my house, though I never knew her, and I like the idea that whole lives were passed and that the woodwork looked about the same, not to mention the plumbing. There is one bright spot or two in all this change. A few blocks away, the neighborhood has managed to install traffic calming islands and speed bumps so that their children are safer in the streets, and given the chance, the kids play outside as long as they can get away with it in the summer, and nobody worries excessively. Some neighbors also have started having family sing-alongs, where we bring any instrument we have and entertain ourselves as people have for eons. I'm kind of on the periphery of what that kind of living implies, and I miss being able to simply step over to my neighbor's house for a cup of tea, but I compensate. I have in mind a kind of Lucy and Ethel situation, and my favorite sister and I are already planning our dotage in a place where we can live close to each other, something we haven't been able to do for 20 years, where we can choose, at least in part, our neighbors. This is Norma Gay Pruitt, trying to love my neighbors almost as much as I love myself, for Mind's Eye Radio.
Although I lived in the city for most of the last 20 years, I never felt connected to the neighborhoods in which I lived. I didn't connect with the couples across the street, each with three or four kids and a fleet of neon-bright big wheels. nor to the lesbian couple next door with their too many Labradors for their small yard, and not with the mysterious night shift workers whom my companion and I called the vampires. Yes, they were all colorful and relatively friendly, but I was always more aware of how close the houses were, of the steady complex hum of noise, and of my inability to ever see the horizon. I simply never felt at home. All this, I know, stems from where I grew up. Until I left for college, I lived in a place much different from an urban neighborhood. I grew up in a rural farming community in a Dutch enclave on the east coast of Wisconsin. Everyone was Dutch, and most people farmed. I grew up with no sidewalks, no movie house, no corner grocery, and no neighbor closer than a quarter mile away. There were cows, pigs, and chickens, corn, wheat, and alfalfa, tractors, plows, and combines. There were catbirds in the pines and owls at dusk. There was quiet. There was space. It was my habitat, the cradle I was born to, and so the 20 years of city living failed to draw me into its patterns. Now I live at the edge of a suburban area. There is space, sometimes quiet, a few neighbors only a little too close, and there is the sun on the horizon. There are fields nearby owned by an absentee farming group that contracts with some company to have the work done. Several times between May and October, huge farm machinery, practically the size of Rhode Island, show up and for an entire day each time plow, scrape, spray herbicide, plant, spray pesticide, and eventually harvest. The noise when they work is an entity deep and pulsing. It vibrates your bones. The air reeks of diesel exhaust. When they plow, the topsoil blows away in a plume. The soil is dusty and dead, just there to hold up the plants. When they spray, the leaves on the field side of the cherry and pear trees in my small orchard are stunted. I keep my cat in on pesticide days. They plant field corn and soybeans in alternating years, crops that are in oversupply. Crops that haven't seen a profitable market selling price in years, but which earn a sizable government price support subsidy every year. This is farming today, and so I've come to know that I cannot recreate my old neighborhood. I cannot ever go back, though I do in memory and in dreams both nostalgic and ambivalent, from which springs this poem, Leaving the Country. No, it is not the harvest. Only the faint drone of lawnmowers in late summer heat. After these 10 years of rented apartments, vanishing garbage, and half-black, sparsely starred nights, still I'm an alien, neither chic nor urbane. Deep in my sleep, before the alarm, pigeons coo in the haymow. Furtive gray doves in the blue spruce windbreak exchange their secret and muted vows. Suddenly, urgently, the ground near the pump house shutters, cracks. I see the snarled root of the basswood exposed as a sign rises up, up like a tree, high over the wide and deepening hole. Neon blinks, uptown, downtown. On the misty descending subway stairs, footprints like dance steps glow slowly. They are for me. I follow breathlessly, lest I be late. When I wake, I'm shaken, back in this city. And lost again. At lunch, my best friend from the office points over her salade niçoise. Look, there, she's wearing the latest Ralph Lauren. Through the glass, I see only a well-muscled shepherd straining its short braided leash. We walk back, and I note the poor health of the trees. Sometimes I fear I may never adapt. That rural Route 1 is tattooed on my wrist, on my forehead, invisible. A third eye bucolically blinks, condemning the city, my small noisy life. It is critical, biased, selective of memory. It will not recall that terrible list, shredded arms, mangled feet, a neighbor boy drowned in a silo of wheat, the lack of cash, of company, of anything not meant to turn dutifully green. And the future of children, predictable, coarse. Time running onto itself in small circles, tripping, mean, a tethered mongrel, and predictable, the depth of winter, massive and blind, a kind of madness, a kind of death, all that led me here, and yet, When the air is like this, hot and hushed, the slow exhalation that is August, I hear tractors, combines, a distant John Deere. When a mower a block over chews through some rambling patch of flowering clover, spews out its fragrance, strong, sweet, familiar. Still my mind fills with haying and that kind of holy work of the fields, the men, the boys, the stronger girls working, throwing the bales, pitching the bales, the baler repeating its mechanical calisthenic, its steady roll, squeal, and spring, the tractor's slow growl, its one headlamp's inadequate glow, a swirl with moths and chaff, the urgent work that goes on from dawn all day, urged and nourished, on all day and long into the mild starry night, because what is sown is grown now, is ready now, is perfect, and will not wait. This is Sharon Van Sluis for Mind's Eye Radio.
I wrote this song after thinking about how even kids in supposedly good neighborhoods turn to drugs. It's called As Wednesday Rolls Around.
The neighborhood feels unfamiliar tonight. Billy swears it could disappear. Some of his friends have found an escape without ever leaving there. They want Billy to join them, but he hasn't given in yet. He just stands fearless, like a moment of respect. And you can always think level, even standing on solid ground. Not all of God's children are smiling as Wednesday rolls around. Now, as Wednesday rolls around, it's another suburban story. Kids just a little too bored. Some of them say that flying high is better than being ignored. But Billy can't understand reasons for turning to what they did. For the times aren't really so bad, just some of the good times are hid. And you can always think level, even standing on solid ground. Not all of God's children are smiling as Wednesday rolls around. Now, as Wednesday rolls around, Billy slips in the back door, feeling his own pain. While his parents have all of their pills to get them to sleep again, and it would be easy for Billy just to be like everyone else. For Sally too can feel like a coffin when you make a stand all by yourself. And you can't always think level, even standing on solid ground. Not all of God's children are smiling this Wednesday rolls around. Now, as Wednesday rolls around,
this is Lynn Patrick Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
You're listening to In the Neighborhood on Mind's Eye Radio. In just a moment, we'll take a look at the customs and rituals of a rather exotic neighborhood, look back more than half a century at a neighborhood's silent stranger, and hear the praises of a neighborhood remembered in song. I'm Greg Willard. Stay with us. Some 20 years ago, Mind's Eye writer Esther Cameron spent several months in a neighborhood in Jerusalem that she remembers vividly even today.
The neighborhood called Bayit Vegan, or House and Garden, occupies a hilltop on the south side of Jerusalem. Its highest and central street, Rehov HaPisgah, or Summit Street, extends for several blocks, and the other streets of the neighborhood are arranged below and around it, like outer rings. All the streets are lined with apartment houses. Here, as in Jerusalem generally, single-family dwellings are a rarity. When I knew the place, in the 80s, the wadis on either side of Bayit Vegan were empty spaces, setting the neighborhood off as a self-enclosed community, a world in itself. Bayit Vegan was and is a religious neighborhood, an ultra-Orthodox neighborhood, as the newspapers like to say. It was not quite the most religious. It was not Mea Sharim, say, or Geula, where all the men wore long side curls and black hats, and all the married women wore tight-fitting kerchiefs. There was a mixture of styles, the inner streets being the most religious. There, especially, life centered on religious observance. As you walked down Summit Street, you could see several large synagogues, but there were also a lot of small ones tucked away in the apartment houses and only revealed to the casual stroller by the sounds of prayer issuing from them. Before and after prayers, on a Sabbath evening or morning, Summit Street was thronged with people strolling along, greeting each other. Friends would eat the Sabbath meal at one another's tables, even staying overnight when it was too far to walk. On the Sabbath you are not supposed to carry things from one house to another, as this is considered work. But if there is a string stretched around a neighborhood or city, they call this the Eruv, the whole neighborhood or city is considered as one household, so that you can take your bottle of wine or whatever to your Sabbath host. There was a women's yeshiva located in Bayit Vegan, and that was how I came to spend several months there. I had hesitated between the yeshiva in Bayit Vegan and a more liberal one where women were allowed to study Talmud, and not all modern ways of dressing and thinking had to be left behind. On the surface, the more modern yeshiva was the more congenial, but something drew me to Bayit Vegan. One of the people who made me feel there was something there I must get to know was a woman I'll call Mrs. Rothman. She was the wife of one of the rabbis who taught at the yeshiva. Her apartment was dark, lined with bookshelves filled with the heavy, dark volumes of religious lore. She wore an elegant wig, and she radiated serenity. One of the things she did was matchmaking. Yeshiva students, male and female, were encouraged and helped to find partners. Sometimes this worked out beautifully, and sometimes it did not. I had a sense of Mrs. Rothman, the matchmaker, as an artist of a sort, and I wanted to see more of the creation she was involved in. So for 4 months I stayed in Bayit Vegan, studying at the yeshiva, and being invited to various people's houses for the Sabbath. How can I tell you what it was like? years before, on a visit to another city. I'd happened on one of those clocks where at a certain hour figures come out and move around and go back in. It was almost time for the hour to strike, so I sat down and waited. Over the next few minutes, other people began to gather. Old men, women pushing baby carriages, young couples, kids, all standing and looking up at the clock. Then the hour struck. A tune began to chime, a door opened, and the little figures emerged. It was all so graceful, not only the music and the figures on the clock, but the pattern formed by the watchers as well. I used to think of that while watching the people in their Sabbath best strolling down Summit Street. A friend of one of the friends I made while living in Bayat Vagan said once that the Orthodox way of living was like living inside a great poem. The people in Bayat Vagan came from many different backgrounds. There were people from the U.S., England, South Africa, Holland, Poland, North Africa. There were even native Israelis, people whose families had been in the country for several generations. At each Sabbath table you heard a different story. The person in Bayat Vagan to whom I became closest, her name was Karen, was a survivor of Bergen-Belsen. Her mother had also survived, a great lady full of dignity and humor. I still sing a song she wrote, a little ditty for the close of the Sabbath. To hear it, you would never guess that the author had ever had a care in the world. The way of life in Bayat Vagan was too rigid for me, and of course people were people in Bayat Vagan just like everywhere else. But whenever I think of Bayat Vagan, I remember something Karen told me after the death of one of her neighbors, a grocer. He had not been a person of wealth or learning, she said, but he was a good man, and nearly everyone in Bayat Vagan had come to his funeral. That made me feel proud of this neighborhood, she said. And I think of two lines by Yeats. How but in order and in ceremony are innocence and beauty born? I feel fortunate to have spent those few months in Bayat Vagan. This is Esther Cameron from Mind's Eye Radio.
When an outsider appears in our midst, that individual gets more than his share of attention from his neighbors. When that outsider's past is something of a mystery, folks get to wondering just what his story is.
Back in the 1940s, Steiner was the mystery man of our neighborhood. Nobody knew where he lived, although he wandered endlessly among the defense plants on Milwaukee's west side. The chain belt factory where they made bombs, the Alice Chalmers plant, where submarine parts were assembled, and the granddaddy of the war plants, the supercharger factory. But Steiner didn't work at these war plants. Rather, he sat in on our baseball practice at the playground, a brown bag tucked inside his faded fatigue jacket. There he offered advice to our Stars of Tomorrow team on fielding, hitting, and pitching. Then his talk typically turned to larger issues.
Ever been to Spain, boys? Spain's the place for a man of adventure. Bullfights every Saturday afternoon, and senoritas. Oh, the senoritas.
He'd smack his lips, then pull the brown bag from his jacket and take a long swallow. Steiner's drinking was what started it all. One afternoon, Rocco Wiggins, the neighborhood tough guy, retrieved one of Steiner's bags from the trash can behind the backstop.
"Will you look at this?" he asked as he pulled a bottle from the paper bag. "Wild frickin' turkey he drinks. My old man over in France getting his ass shot off, and this miserable bastard drinking wild turkey."
In fact, Rocco's old man spent the war at Fort Dix, training GIs to drive deuce-and-a-halves. But Rocco's discovery that Steiner may have financial resources made us think. Rocco wanted to know,
"How the hell does Steiner afford wild turkey?"
"He's got a stash," Doug Freilich answered.
"Yeah, he's got a stash somewhere nearby."
Well, after that, Rocco took to shadowing Steiner around the neighborhood. Wherever you saw Steiner, you were likely to see Rocco 100 yards behind, waiting to discover where the wild turkey money came from. Nights, Steiner could be found at his regular stool at the far end of Nub's bar.
It's all over for the Italians. Don't have the character for war. They got beat in Abyssinia, got beat in Greece, got beat everywhere they fought. When I was in Spain, the Germans raked the loyalist lines like a reaper cutting grain. I sent dispatches that my editor never printed, never even considered.
His editor. Steiner claimed he'd been a foreign correspondent for the Milwaukee Journal before he took one in the head near Seville and retired on disability. Of all his stories, that was the hardest to believe. He'd lean back on the bleachers behind the Ball Diamond and take a swig from his bottle.
Ever been to Berlin, boys? I was there in 33. Eyewitness to Kristallnacht. Eyewitness to things you boys should never see. Terrible sights.
Our mothers ordered us to stay away from him, claiming he was dangerous, which only made the mystery of Steiner more fascinating. He told us he'd worked alongside Teddy White in Berlin and met Ed Murrow in London. In cold weather, Steiner rode the number 16 bus from one end of the line to the other, then back again. He sat in the jump seat across from the driver and cadged cigarettes from passengers, commenting on the state of the world. Hitler was done for after North Africa. Roosevelt was a communist who wanted to turn us into the United States of Russia. The Red Sox would take the pennant next year, even without Ted Williams in the lineup. Steiner was part of the landscape, accepted or endured, depending on your point of view. While we went about our lives, Steiner was a set piece, anchoring his little corner of the neighborhood. On VJ Day, they found Steiner in the alley between Joey Sanger's drugstore and the Paradise Theater. His body was covered by a sheet of cardboard, his head cradled on a newspaper proclaiming victory over Japan. His head had been smashed with a blunt instrument, a lead pipe or a baseball bat. The police took pictures, asked a few questions, then returned to the diner to exchange war stories with customers. The Milwaukee Journal was filled with news from the Pacific. Steiner's obituary ran only 5 lines. He was taken to the Fairhoven Funeral Parlor after they discovered that he did have a stash, an account at the savings and loan. $14,000 in all, enough for Fairhoven to give him a first-class send-off, attended by one reporter from the Journal, 2 drivers on the number 16 bus, and 6 of us boys from the Stars of Tomorrow. After that, memories of Steiner faded as quickly as dust in a summer shower. The following summer, the city put up a memorial to honor men who had died in the war. Steiner's name was not on the memorial. He was a casualty, but of what, nobody could say. This is Dick Radke for Mind's Eye Radio.
Songwriter Paul Thompson celebrates Williamson Street, sung here by Angela Smith and Cindy Harrington, with guitar and arrangement by Angela Smith.
Cream cones, and when we got home, loved to
This is In the Neighborhood on Mind's Eye Radio. Coming up, we'll look at what happens when neighbors are asked to help care for a fellow resident, take a ride through the neighborhood on a mission of joy and mercy, and see the role a neighborhood sometimes plays in the coming-of-age saga. I'm Greg Willard. We'll be back in a moment. Stick around, won't you? If it takes a village to raise a child, it might also be said that it takes a neighborhood to care for an impaired elder. As we see in Evie Thompson's dramatic vignette, Losing the Keys.
My husband John and I are driving as fast as we can over to my dad's house. We got a call from Dad's neighbor, Audrey. She told me that my dad, Art, had backed his car into the field across from his house. There's been a lot of these incidents in the 2 years since Mom passed on. Dad's memory loss and impaired judgment have really given us all a lot of trouble. One time, Dad couldn't remember how to stop his Ryder lawnmower, and he had to drive it until it finally ran out of gas. Then there was that fender bender he was involved with just last month. John and I have been particularly concerned about the driving because someone could get badly hurt. We just haven't figured out what to do about it.
Well, will you look at this? The whole neighborhood has turned out. And who's that sticking his head in your dad's car window?
Marvin Handel. He lives two doors down. Hi, Marvin.
Hi, I was just talking to your dad. Art, I wish you'd let me help.
Marvin, you can't help. Just go away. I'm busy here.
Art, why don't you let me drive it in the garage for you?
No. I'm just backing up to get a run at it.
Dad?
This darn thing. There's something wrong with the shift. I don't know why those hotshots at the garage can't get it fixed.
Dad, I think it might be a good idea if we went in the house and sat a while. Come on, Dad. John can look after the car. We can have a good talk.
Oh, all right. I'll deal with this later.
Do you think they're gonna be okay?
Yeah, they'll get it sorted out.
Sad about Art. More and more these days, he's losing it.
Yeah, a nice guy and a good neighbor.
Well, see ya.
Yeah, don't work too hard.
Why don't you sit here, Dad, in the recliner next to the window? I see you've got your binoculars out. I'll bet you've been watching the squirrels. It always leaves me a little heartsick to see this room, because it has become such a mess. The drapes are coming off the slides. There's first-class mail, junk mail, and newspapers, all mixed up on the table. Every time I offer to clean it up, Dad refuses. Ah, there goes John driving Dad's car into the garage. Hope we can keep Dad distracted from it for a while.
I have to go out and see about the car.
Oh, no, Dad. John's taking care of it.
He doesn't know the car the way I do.
John will be here in a moment, Dad. Just sit back down.
Everything's okay.
I want to check on the car. Where are the keys? I need the keys.
Oh, Dad, I think they got lost. I hope he will accept that. I've heard of other people that managed it that way with their loved ones.
Art, I've got the keys, and I'm keeping them.
Well, of all the... Give them to me. You heard me. Give them to me.
No, Art. You've had too many accidents. You don't want to hurt or kill someone, do you?
Why don't we all sit down? I'll make us some coffee. A nice pot of coffee. Dad scowls. For a minute, I'm afraid he's going to hit John. Then he returns to his chair. I feel like crying. As I glance over my shoulder out the picture window, I can see Dad's neighbor, Audrey, heading over, carrying something. In the living room, Dad sits, looking at the floor. He was a big man, head of his own construction business. Now, sitting in the recliner, he seems so frail and shrunken. I go into the kitchen and start the coffee.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, Audrey. What's this?
Oh, I made some apple pie for lunch, and it's not bad. Just thought you might like some.
Oh, Audrey, how kind.
I just wanted to tell you. We went through all this with my mother a few years back, and I understand what it's like. It's rough.
Yeah. Some days I don't know how I'm going to get through it, like today. We had to take his keys away.
Now, don't you worry about that. It had to be done. Something had to be done.
I don't know. He may never forgive us.
Well, Art's a smart guy. He doesn't mow the lawn anymore. He's letting Marvin do it. He knows he might forget how to operate the mower again. And at some level, he knows he shouldn't be driving.
I feel terrible about this. It's like treating him like a child.
I know, honey. I know. You look like you could use a hug. There, there, honey. You will get through this. Maybe not gracefully all the time. I don't know anyone who's done it gracefully. We'll all try to help where we can. And you just keep putting one foot in front of the other.
Mind's Eye players include Evie Thompson, Paul Thompson, Dick Radke, Fran Rall, and George Spelvin. A simple walk through the neighborhood on a late fall day can become a defining moment to a parent out on a small adventure with his young daughter. That's what happened to Guyther Valtzen one special evening after delivering meals on coaster wagon wheels in their neighborhood.
It's late November, a clear and cold Sunday evening, and I am a block from home, towing Aaron, my red-headed 3-year-old, in our wagon. We have just finished delivering meals to neighbors, and when we stop, the only sound is the soft buzz of the streetlight and the distant hum of traffic. "There's our fingernail moon," I say, pointing through the bare tree branches in the southwest sky. "Uh-uh," Aaron shakes her head. "That's our smiling moon." Our moons. The bowl of ice cream moon, the slice of watermelon moon, the golden egg moon, the pizza pie moon, the too shy to come out moon. I ask Aaron if she's ready for the ride. "Yes, Papa," is her instant response. We have done this before, and she knows the routine, sliding up to her place in the front of the wagon, scrunching her feet up against the red wooden rails. "Let's check for cars," I suggest, being as responsible as I can given the relative irresponsibility of careening down a dusky street in a radio flyer. But our crash helmets are intact, thick wool hats over even thicker Norwegian skulls. Aaron whips her head back and forth, too quickly to see anything. "No cars, Papa." I check, just in case. I ease the wagon to the center of the street. The hill is not steep. In fact, if you're in a car, you barely notice whether you're going up or down. But in a wagon, a couple of pushes and you're rolling at a good, steady, rattling clip. I glance over my shoulder once more for cars and take hold of the black tubular handle, which is designed for pulling and precarious at best for steering. Holding the handle straight up and over Aaron's ducked head, I then place my left foot in the wagon behind her. "Ready," I shout. "Ready, set, go," Aaron replies. I start pushing off with my right foot, then swing myself to squatting in the wagon behind her. We are free. We are vibrating. We are noisy. But Aaron, as usual, goes quietly. This is not a petrified silence. It is just her way. As a parent trying to do a decent job of not traumatizing my kid, I've often had to look Aaron deep in the eyes to get a read on her experience. This experience, I know, is tried and true. Even so, I lean forward, my hands held over her, clutching the swaying control stick, just to catch the gleam in her wide-open eyes and the subtle upturn of her grin. The squeak rattle of the wagon fills the empty night. I worry if the thin metal axles will hold this full-grown man and small child, knowing that one loose screw could spell disaster, or at least a painful spill, a jackknifed wreck in the street. Fleetingly, I doubt my sanity. I also expect, maybe secretly hope, that our neighbors, Diane and Steve, Rosemary and Mike, Jane and Joe, Kimberly, the Dormans, will step out on their front porches to see what all the ruckus is about, to shake their heads and purse their lips, or better yet, to laugh with us. But it is November, and no one shows the sluggishness of winter's hibernation already settling in. "Hooey!" I shout as we reach our house. "Hooey!" echoes Erin, breaking her blissful silence. This night, though, I don't want it to end, and we blow right past our driveway. I want us to fly on into the night, clattering away, disappearing into that dark field of stars above us, riding right up and over that smile-in-the-sky moon. This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio.
Baby, don't say a word, but I'm gonna buy you a mockingbird. And if that mockingbird won't sing, Papa gonna buy you a diamond ring. And if that diamond ring is brass, Papa gonna buy you a looking glass. And if that looking glass will break, Papa gonna buy you a chocolate cake.
Yes, ma'am.
Growing up in a neighborhood often calls upon us to assert ourselves physically. In her neighborhood in Buffalo, New York, Louise Mancuso endured that rite of passage first on a skating pond and later in an unfamiliar neighborhood some distance from her home. But it taught Mancuso a valuable lesson about when to leave well enough alone.
In 1950s Buffalo, New York, as a freshman in high school, it was my objective, for a short moment in the wrinkle of time on a Sunday afternoon, to try and scare up a pair of ice skates to use at Cazenovia Park. On the south side of town, the pond there had frozen over, and my best friend Dee had gotten it into her head that we needed to go skating that day, though neither she nor I had the equipment to do so. "We can borrow skates," she said, even though neither she nor I knew of any friends who owned a pair. We did not live in a posh neighborhood, nor anywhere near one, but Dee was adamant, leading us to knock on doors of friends of friends of friends until we had each glommed onto a pair of skates from people we didn't even remotely know. And not only that, four of them decided they wanted to go along with us as well. Which was fine, but we never did get to skate, since only minutes after we arrived, a boy came whizzing by and decided to reach out and touch me as we stood on the ice, then make a quick getaway. My borrowed skates, that were much too big and belonged to someone's brother, slipped out from under me and I landed flat on my back, my right wrist slapping the hard ice like a cracked whip. The others in our group stood and watched as Dee struggled to help me to my feet, then hobble off the pond to a bench on the snow-covered grass. My wrist hurt like hell, but I didn't cry, maybe because of the shock, but more likely because of all the strangers around, and I didn't want to be seen as losing my cool. The girls were a bit on the rough side, let's say, and not the kind of people Dee and I would ordinarily be hanging out with. The hospital, where I had my appendix taken out a few years before, was right across the street, so Dee got her and my skates off. Then we made our way to the emergency room to see what damage had been done to my wrist, which was now noticeably red and swollen. The others didn't follow per my request. I still hadn't cried, but when the receptionist told us we would have to wait a few minutes before a doctor was available, I sat down and let the floods come. Of course, it was at that moment the other girls appeared in the doorway, curious as to how I was doing. They didn't hide their disgust, seeing me totally dissolved in tears, my nose all red and drippy. We thought you were tough, the tallest one sneered. What did the doctor say? He told her we hadn't seen him yet. You mean she's crying like that and doesn't even know what, if anything, is wrong? That remark got Dee's dander up, and she retorted with something like, her arm's probably broken, you idiot, and she's a whole lot tougher than the likes of you. To which the taller one replied with a threat that went something like, oh yeah, we'll see about that. We're going to find out what happened to her arm, and then we're going to beat the crap out of her. With that, they left. My wrist had indeed been broken in 5 different places. Dee and I stayed pretty close to our own neighborhood after that, and by spring I was finally starting to breathe a little easier, not having heard from the girl who made the threat. Then I got a call from Dee late one night, after I had already gone to bed. They know you've got the cast off, she said. We've got to meet them in a half hour outside of Clavoon's. She named a bar that was a 20-minute walk away. I'll be over in 5 minutes. Be waiting downstairs. Are you crazy? I yawned. I was in bed, practically asleep. My mom will be home pretty soon. She'd kill me if I got in a fight. My mother worked a 3-to-11 shift and wouldn't be home till after midnight. They'll come to your house if you don't meet them tonight. I was the one who picked the place. It's out in the open, and we won't run into anyone we know. My dad's at the corner saloon, I told her, latching onto another excuse for not wanting to leave my nice, safe bed. He could come home any minute, and then I'd be in big trouble. Come on, Lou, we'll be there and back before anyone even knows you're gone. So here's me and Dee at the scene, and here are these 4 other girls. Dee is egging them on, no help at all. My knees are shaking, my teeth chattering on this mild spring evening. I am scared to death, but I have to go through with it. I remember seeing a fight at school, the bigger girl pounding the smaller one's head on the cement bathroom floor, and no one, especially me, doing anything to stop it. I don't want to get my skull cracked, and I don't want to crack anyone else's, but I'm stuck. It's been set up. I have to fight, or there will be no end to the way I'll be picked on by anyone who decides to do so. My heart is beating out of my chest. My legs have been threatening to give out from under me. I remember thinking, oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God, and then squeezing my eyes tight, lowering my head and flailing out with my arms, a windmill gone berserk. I do this for maybe the count of 10 and keep doing it, even though I think I hear someone saying something in the background. Not Dee, but someone else. I keep my eyes shut and my arms are still flailing until Dee says, you can stop now, Lou. You got her. You got her good. I open my eyes and by golly, there's the girl lying on the sidewalk, blood dribbling from her nose. Her companions are looking at me, surprise in their eyes, 2 of them on either side of their fallen warrior, while the 3rd stands behind them, shaking her head. You got her, Dee says again. You did good. She won't be bothering you anymore. And then Dee is pulling on my arm, trying to get me to go, but I keep standing there trying to figure out how in the world I did it. You started swinging your arms and got her with one of your fists right in the beginning when she tried to get in close. Come on, she says, before the others decide to get involved. But I am feeling cocky. I did it. I knocked someone down and drew blood, not even meaning to. You better not mess with me anymore, I say, or you'll get more of the same. Oh, wrong thing to do. The look of surprise on their faces turns to one of menace. No fool, except for the previous faux pas. I turn my back to them with the coolest of cool and beat a hasty retreat. Luckily, no one follows. Dee and I drifted apart not long after that. She began hanging around with a tougher crowd, got suspended from school for wearing mascara, and became an unwed mother. Dee actually was the cool one, being the first in our neighborhood to wear peg-legged sharkskin pants and get a D.A., that's duck's ass, haircut. A girl named Alice, a square who wore saddle shoes and Peter Pan collars and lived in a neighborhood closer to school, was to become my best friend in sophomore year. As for me, I guess I was somewhere in the middle. I wore saddle shoes sometimes, and when I wasn't in my school uniform, my favorite outfits consisted of black open-throat blouses, upturned collar, of course, Levi's, and loafers. I still came across as being tough, but deep down I wanted what everyone else did, to belong and be liked, by people I felt most comfortable with. Can you dig it? Cool. This is Louise Mancuso for Mind's Eye Radio.
That's our show. Thanks for listening to In the Neighborhood from Mind's Eye Radio Collective of Madison, Wisconsin. Kelly Warren is our producer. Contributing writers include Esther Cameron, Louise Mancuso, Kathy Miner, Norma Gay Pruitt, Dick Radke, Lynn Patrick Smith, Evie Thompson, Paul Thompson, Guy Thervalson, and Sharon Van Sluis. Original music by Barbara Chusin. If you'd like a copy of this show or would like more information about Mind's Eye Radio, call 608-276-9425 or log on to our website at www.mindseyeaudio.com. We welcome your comments on this and other Mind's Eye shows. Send your comments to www.mindseyeaudio.com. I'm your host, Greg Willard, leaving you with the words of Edgar Watson Howe from his collection, Country Town Sings. What people say behind your back is your standing in the community. Until next time, best wishes from Mind's Eye Radio.